Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat podcast. With us today, we have Ian Litchfield. Hello.
Hello there.
Hi. Can you tell the audience just a short summary, kind of like who you are, what you do, and I guess where we are?
Well, we're based in Tewkesbury in Gloucestershire. We own a garage, a tuning company, and we've been in business for 26, 27 years now. So, yeah, been going a while.
Yeah, and predominantly tuning and working on all sorts of cars.
Yeah, right? Tuning, servicing, upgrades, paintwork, paint protection, kind of anything all in one shop, basically tires, you name it, we do it.
Yeah, it's expanded significantly. I think the first time the only time I've been here before was, we were talking about this earlier, it was probably like 4 years ago, and you were doing something on the original sort of M2. I was pondering some suspension change or something. And since then, there's like, I remember thinking there was a lot of GTRs when I came here the first time, and now there's like a million GTRs absolutely everywhere, like four cars deep. And then the last time we spoke was at the Supercar Driver secret meet, but in 2022. Mm-hmm. And just after we'd done our podcast, I'm pretty sure we didn't talk about it on the podcast. You showed me some pictures of a car, like a sort of rendering.
Right, yes.
Which then became the Praga Behemoth, which I think was sort of being shown at that event in private. Can you talk a little bit about being involved with that car and what that project's been like to sort of work on?
Yeah, amazing. We have done in the past quite a few projects for manufacturers, but this was nice to have like a fresh start working directly with them on it. So it uses from our side, it uses the GTR engine. So we can spec it however they want it, basically. So we build the engines. It gives them a really lightweight, very powerful, but most importantly, very reliable engine. I think a lot of the hypercars at the moment have quite exotic V12s that need huge servicing. And this is a much simpler, proven option, basically. And it works great. The car's amazing. It's extremely light. And having driven it, I drove it at Dunsfold. It's the quickest thing you can imagine.
Yeah. It looks. I mean, it looks awesome. And we know the powertrain works.
The engineering in general, the thing that shocked me most when I saw the finished product was just how good the quality of the machining, the design. There's so many clever things. Well, that's amazing how they've done that. Where they've hidden like coolers and ducts, the carbon fiber work. The quality is higher than anything I've seen. And if you've seen most kind of hypercars, supercars, this thing's really special. And we know the efforts they've gone to in the engineering side. So yeah, so putting in the GTR engine is a great option.
So having that engine in that car, you've worked on, how different is that to another engine that you would put into another GTR?
It's different that it's not four-wheel drive. So the actual GTR engine is actually quite compact, but it's reasonably long because it has the four-wheel drive system underneath, or the shafts for the four-wheel drive. So we can get rid of all of that and have a dry sump. And it then means it can sit very low in the car. The engine itself is essentially just a GTR engine. It's got some upgraded parts, some stuff we've learned, some stronger parts that go into it just to make it absolutely bomb-proof. They are really strong anyway. And yeah, so power to weight rise, it's about as good as you can get.
And then that's, I think in standard format, it's like
700 horsepower, which is nothing for that setup.
Yeah. So have you had customers come back and go?
Well, the first one's in production now.
Okay.
There's been lots of discussions about options. The thing is the options are kind of limitless. So we just work with Praga for what they want their customers to experience, because there's a lot more to it. You can't just chuck a 1,000 horsepower engine in it, because you just spend all of that time spinning the wheels. But there's a way you can do it, so I'm sure that will come in the future.
Yeah, and well, it's a super light car, isn't it?
Like, yeah, it's very light.
1,200 or something.
It's less than that. It's just over 1,000 kilos.
Oof. So, yeah,
yeah, it's an absolute monster.
That is an absolute monster. And on the way up here, I was looking back at some of the things that have been on your website, and you sort of talked about a little bit on social media, and I was wondering, I was like, I don't really know what's going on in the GTR world right now. What is, in terms of what you guys do, and also because they've stopped production now.
They stopped production for Europe, so they still make it for Japan and America. Okay. I don't know for how much longer, but they are still doing it for those markets.
And have they said they're going to do a successor?
It's always been on the cars, but they've not got any prototypes testing yet. From what we understand, we've got reasonable knowledge of what they're doing in terms of those things. But they've got nothing at the plant. I'd expect it to be an all-electric, completely different car, which is why I think the values of the GTR have held so well.
Yeah. And is it still, well, it looks like it's still massively popular amongst a certain...
Yeah, it's great. It's an amazing car. I don't think there's anything else that gives you that kind of level of performance without the drama. You know, it does it so easily. We've got McLarens and things like that. The closest would be the latest 992 Turbo S in terms of performance. Yeah. But even that, you know, the GTR with some, you know, choice modifications will be somewhat quicker, and it's more practical, and it's, you know, all those other things, and much cheaper. So,
yeah. Are you still developing your sort of GTR packages and stuff? What are you sort of working on at the moment?
Yeah, we're sat in our R&D office at the minute. We've got three guys in here that just do making new parts. It's making parts to replace things that are wearing out, make them stronger. Parts to replace things that might become particularly expensive from Nissan. And then obviously the tuning components. So we've got suspension arms, you know, to adjust alignment settings. We've got billet engine blocks, we've got turbo kits, we've got our own compressor wheels and compressor covers for turbos, everything designed for the GTR.
Something's rowdies in the background. And are you sort of starting to get to the point where you've got most of the parts? You've now starting to have made a lot of parts of the car?
No, we do make quite a lot, particularly on the drivetrain. We make a lot of parts for that. But there's still a lot of parts we buy from Nissan. You know, we buy a huge amount of components from Nissan.
And have they historically kept making parts for a long time?
Yeah, we've never seen. And in fact, they're actually remaking things like R32, R34 parts now in the historic range, like the blocks and stuff like that. So I think they understand the importance of holding value in classic cars. And because the GTR is not made anymore for Europe, it's starting to get that sort of classic status. And everyone loves it. You know, there's no pretension to it. It's just a ridiculous thing.
Just a crazy thing. What are the, in terms of packages and stuff that you offer now, what are the sort of standard packages that someone could come in for?
Well,
sort of just keep going
probably,
up and
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I mean, you have what we would class say a stage one, which takes the power to sort of 615 horsepower. That's obviously very popular. The next step up is like full kind of bolt-on parts, all the exhaust parts, intake parts, bigger fuel injectors. And then you'll be running kind of 660 horsepower, something of that order. We do lots of those. That's kind of the limit of where the standard engine turbos that kind of reach a maximum then. And then you're getting into kind of exponential costs for tuning at that point.
Yeah. No, and walking around, there are what look like a lot of exceptionally serious GTRs here.
Yeah.
Are these a sort of mix of track cars, drag cars, road cars, or predominantly road?
A lot of track cars, some road cars that people build. They just like the idea of creating something bespoke for them. That's the nice thing about the car. It's a blank canvas. You can build what you want. And the performance levels you can get to are frightening with the things. They're so quick.
Yeah, I think one of the times, probably the first time you were telling me about going to the Nürburgring in a particularly, I think, lightweight, you'd made a really lightweight GTR,
mm-hmm.
Like full carbon everything and whatnot. Yeah, it looks like it's pretty mad. And
yeah, we built cars that are almost like GT3 cars that are road legal. And, you know, then they got aero and lighter. they are crazy fast.
And walking around the garage, you've got a GT1 car.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got all the parts for the GT1 car. So they won the championship in 2011. We've got a shell that we've built up with all the parts. We're just waiting to put the engine in. So we'll probably do sort of gentleman racing and things, shows and stuff with that in the coming years, I think.
That would be quite cool.
It is a very cool thing, yeah.
And like running with the cars that exist at that point in time.
Yeah, you've got the Maserati, you've got the DB9, there's some, you know, sailings, there's some really cool cars in that championship. So
yeah, like, and most GT1 cars I come across, I know some are cheaper to run than others. Are the Nissan GT1s, are they like kind of full of just like rocking horse stuff?
Well, the rumor is they were £1 million each.
Yeah,
they had the ex-Ferrari engineer Nigel Stepney. He designed it for Nissan, so there's very little GTR left of it. It's a V8 rear-wheel drive, all carbon fiber. It's crazy. Yeah, it's a crazy car, but it's so well engineered and it's just a cool thing and it sounds amazing, the V8, and yeah, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's quite cool. And you managed to get like truckloads of parts.
Yeah, we literally had like three huge transporters worth of parts. We've got all sorts, gearboxes and carbon parts and stuff for it. So yeah, it should keep us going for a while.
Are there things like now you, I think you feel like you've got some 3D printers behind me.
Yeah, we've got a couple of 3D printers, yeah.
What are you using those for?
Those are used for like prototyping. So if we make, I don't know, a new turbo component or exhaust manifold, we can 3D print it, offer it up some size. On a GTR sizes, the packaging is very tight. So you have to adjust all the sizing just right. So it's much easier to scan something in, 3D print. You can bolt it on, you can check the clearances and just evolve it from there before you go to the cost of casting something or CNCing something.
Nice. Can you make any parts that go directly on at the moment?
We can make most parts, yeah. They've got two Scots in our R&D department. So one Scot runs it, the other Scot is an unbelievably talented fabricator, but equally brilliant with like CAD design. So he knocks stuff up in no time, then we 3D print it. But the guys are unbelievably good.
Yeah, it looks like it's particularly for things that, one, you're testing and development, obviously that makes a lot of sense, but then with cars, for example, like the GT1, where parts are getting harder and harder or just insanely expensive.
Yeah, I mean, it's not all kind of commercial. A lot of the stuff we make because we can and we enjoy it. There's almost no commercial value to doing it. We're just in the process of revising our intercoolers. There's nothing wrong with our intercoolers, but
yeah,
some of our suppliers have come up with new designs for the cores. We thought, oh, we'll revisit now that we can do fabrication in-house more easily. We'll CNC the end tanks and we'll do flow dynamics on that. And you just say there's no commercial reason for doing it. You just can. So that'll be coming soon. And they do improve the performance of what we had before. Like the Yaris intercooler, we do really well with those. We do loads of BMW kind of E92, E46 oil coolers.
Mm-hmm.
We just fabricate those in-house because we've got them ourselves. A lot of the guys have got M-cars. Yeah. I've got an E92. So, yeah, we make a lot of parts that we would need for ourselves. So,
And then if someone, yeah.
And it's over, almost brilliant. That's brilliant. That's great. That helps. Yeah. Yeah.
And having a look around, you've got a massive dyno. Do most stuff, do most cars that you tune, do they sort of go on the dyno before and after?
Well, they can do. It depends. Sometimes, for example, just logistically, you can't, because if you put a car on to run it first and then you've got to take the exhaust off and it's all red hot, and the customer needs to leave by the end of the day, it's not saying that it can be done. But yeah, we do a lot of back-to-back testing. We have a lot of our own development cars. We try and we're lucky because we're busy, we can kind of pick the cars we enjoy. So then we'll develop our own cars and then those products will become available. So we do a lot of stuff in-house.
And what's popular now? What are you seeing either demand for or a lot of customers wanting to do at the moment?
We've always done a lot of Porsche, a lot of BMW. We do a lot of BMW chassis stuff, suspension and parts for the M cars, F cars, the new G series. We're doing a range of arms and suspension kits for those. So that's really popular. We're doing a lot of McLaren at the moment. We seem to be very busy with McLaren. So that's proving good business for us. We've done a lot of simple engine repair work on them, a lot of tuning on them, suspension bits. So the McLaren's looking good.
I've heard a lot of stuff about McLaren engines recently. And have you seen a lot of sort of common, are people coming in with failures, like stuff that's broken and then you're fixing it?
They're not, obviously we're seeing the minority.
Yeah.
There's the vast majority have no issues at all. There are a couple of issues that we're starting to see with the engine design, which leads to kind of premature wear, one to do with the chains and the valve type stuff. But they're relatively easy to fix. They're not something that would put me off. We've got McLaren up.
Yeah.
And 570. It wouldn't put me off having another McLaren. It's just things to be aware of. The GTR, every car seems to have some kind of Achilles heel that you need to understand what it is and then you can fix it easily. And the McLarens, we've done a few 720s. Beginning of the year, we've done two or three 570s with similar kind of VVT issues. But again, the McLaren are good to deal with in terms of parts. The engines are actually really easy to work on. It's pretty straightforward.
Nice. And I guess you see that with all sorts of manufacturers. If people are still working on cars, it's not quite at that timeline with a McLaren, but let's say 10 years later, you know, someone's still working on a Metzger 997 engine or whatever. They're like, oh, well, whilst we're in there, we change X, Y, Z, just some coolant pipe type stuff or whatever, because we now know after you've run it for 10 years.
And these the manufacturers do as well. And so you'll see subtle changes in the design of the engine or the components that you can retrospectively fit to the older engine.
Right. Yeah.
And I think people assume that these things will go on forever, and every car, whether it's a Porsche or whatever the thing, might have a fantastic reliability record, but they still need repair work and servicing when mechanical things go wrong. But if you can spot the weaknesses, you can then do various things to mitigate that in the future.
Yeah, and when you look at any of the modern McLarens now, whether it's like a 570, 650, et cetera, the car you get for the money, like, because a 570 is a cheap car now. I don't know what they cost. Like, can you get one for like 60 grand or something?
Yeah. It's we've seen a lot of our GTR customers switch across.
Interesting.
Not necessarily because McLaren's better, just they fancy a change. They've had the GTR for 10 years. They just fancy something different. And the McLaren's, it looks fantastic. It goes really well. And they also have the reassurance that they know they can turn to us if they need any help. So that helps an awful lot as well.
And you do some work on them and then they're like 800 horsepower or something hilarious like that.
Yeah, they have more power than they could ever need, put it that way. And we do things you can do simple things. Like the turbos are, we had Eva Magazine drove one of our cars a year or so ago and they really enjoyed it because the turbos are relatively old fashioned. So you can modernize the turbos and the response to the engine is better. It makes more power. They don't have a mechanical diff. They use the wheels to clamp. I found with the 570 and 600LT on track that you could upset the stability control and it would start sort of second guessing what it was going to do. But if you put a mechanical diff in it, which is what they've just done on the newer cars, then suddenly the thing's a lot more stable. You know, there's a reason why powerful rear wheel drive cars have a mechanical diff in the back of them. So, and whilst I think this is the same with a lot of manufacturers is that they, in CAD design, and in concept, it all works perfectly. But in the real world, Lotus once said that you'd never need to put roll bars on cars if you do the suspension properly, but every car's roll bars on it. You know, it's
yeah.
what you think is going to work versus what actually works is two different things. So, yeah, some subtle changes. You get a lot more grip, a lot more traction. It's easier to control. Yeah, just everything about the car works better with some choice changes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so if you buy a... can you get a 570 for like 60 grand, something like that?
You probably can now, some high mileage ones, yeah. I mean, the thing is, you get a lot of stuff on the internet where they'll show like auctions, stuff selling for nothing, but you don't know the history of the car or the condition, you know. Who knows what that car is to be that cheap? But I think they're around 60 to 90 grand, depending on age and mileage and stuff. And that's a lot of car for the money.
It is. It's like carbon tub.
Yeah.
Like supercar. You don't have all the trick suspension that on the 720 and stuff, but you also don't have that to go wrong if that goes wrong. And then, yeah, you can do some tuning on the engine
and modernize it. It feels like a proper supercar as well.
Yeah.
You know, I love my Porsches. They're amazing, but they feel more run-of-the-mill than McLaren. McLaren feels pretty special when you drive it.
Yeah. I think in terms of Porsches, I think last time I saw you... Were you running a GT3 or was it still the Carrera?
I've still got the Carrera T. We've got a GT3. Yeah, they're amazing.
Have you done some stuff with them?
Did an exhaust system for GT3 just because we can. Yeah. Not that I don't know if you sold more than a handful, it's not something we really push. Yeah, we do bits and pieces. We do an alignment because they're very sensitive to alignment. So we spent a lot of time messing with our own car, get the chassis set up right. So we do a lot of alignment setups. We've got GT4 on the alignment ramp at the moment. We've had a few of those. They're just great cars. They're so well made. So we really enjoy working on them.
And when with a car like that, in terms of geo, what are you sort of adapting it for? Are you making it a better road car or better all route, sort of in terms of, for you anyway?
They're so sensitive to the right setup. So when they come from the manufacturer, they might be within tolerance for what they'll accept for the steering wheel straight, the car, you know, goes around a bend, it all works. But if you dial it in just ever so slightly and you just perfect it and just spend time really on it, then the car drives better. It's smoother. The steering gives you more in feedback. You're more confident as a driver. It's more stable at speed. It's more keen to turn in. So all those things can be achieved just with subtle geometry changes. And naturally, you hit potholes. You knock things out of alignment. They just need resetting kind of once a year just to be optimized.
It's something I need to keep reminding myself because I had on my 997, I had a Geo done ages and ages and ages ago and it like transformed the car.
Yeah.
But I think in my head, I always have that as like, I mean, it still drives straight, but I've done a lot of stuff since then. I'm sure it's like...
It will. There's a lot of really, really good companies in the UK that spend their whole, that is their job, you know, doing alignment setups because it makes such a big difference. We've got two of the top of the range Hunter alignment machines specifically for doing these sort of jobs because we're so busy doing it, and then you can get a printout before and after, you can see the difference, and you can save it. And if the car comes back in and the customer can then check, or we can check how it compares to how it went out last time. We've been doing a lot of 600LT McLarens because they tend to understeer on circuit, so you can adjust the setup of those quite easily to allow them to turn in better, generate more front grip. So, and some of it is the manufacturer will put quite sedate settings in because they have to cater to the majority of owners rather than the guys that specifically want to drive it quickly. It's not necessarily going to make it more nervous, but it, you know, it might turn in quicker than some customers are used to, and it might, you know, that might put them off. So they have a bit more of a sort of softer setting, so we can tailor it to the customer.
And there's quite a lot of adjustability from factory on something like a 600 LT.
Yeah, you have to do it with shims a lot, which is quite time consuming, but it makes it more durable. But yeah, there's a lot of adjustment you can make. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Because that's something you never really hear about when you're buying a car, the manufacturer. So you hear from some, I'd say smaller manufacturers, they go, well, you can have like a sort of more track biased setup or a sort of road setup, possibly with a bit more understeer, etc. But you never sort of, never take delivery of, I don't know, GT3 or something. And then they'd be like, which suspension setup do you want?
Well, yeah, there's that, isn't it? I'd say they have to cater for most. And unfortunately, most GT3 owners aren't going to go on a track day. they are just going to take it out on a weekend drive. Yeah. And car will be brilliant. It'll be give them no fuss. The dealer will be happy. The manufacturer will get no moaning. Everything will be great. But you can just dial it in. The Porsche own Manti. The whole point of Manti is they do chassis work to make your Porsche go around the track faster. And there's a reason they're so successful, and they're rammed with work, because, you know, there's a big gains to be had.
It is, and the Nürburgring, it does seem like a good place for implementing those sorts of changes and then posting a lap time, because it's so long.
Yes.
Like you go, oh, a Manti GT2 RS is like 15 seconds faster than a factory one or whatever. Like,
but a lot of that is tyres. I mean, that's the other thing. They'll often have the stickier tyre. Well, there's two thirds of the lap time. And they spend a lot of time doing it. It's that car is dialed in for that circuit. Yeah, it probably won't work at Silverstone. Well, it doesn't work at Silverstone. You'd have to change the settings. But it's also fun, isn't it? You can tailor the car to what you want, how you drive. You can make improvements. You can feel like it's your specific car. It's not just an off-the-shelf thing that you've bought.
I love the idea of the new RS with the adjustable dials.
Yes.
Have you had a go?
I'm not doing it on track, no. But it looks amazing. But I know I'd spend so much time messing around with... We do a lot of work with Nitron, and they've got an electronic valve that you can do similar stuff.
Okay.
The chief engineer there, Curtis, is a good friend of mine. We've known each other forever. We still play football together every week. We just waste so much time messing with damper setting, going round and round in circles, never really getting anywhere. Because we decide one minute that we prefer the way it rides on here and it handles better there. But yeah, I can imagine those engineers must have spent a lot. And then you can adjust the diff as well.
Yeah.
So it's almost too much for somebody.
The inner geek in me loves this idea.
Yeah.
I'm like, that would just be awesome.
Yeah.
I'm sure in reality you're probably over adjusting the entire time.
But even when we fit adjustable dampers to customers' cars now, they don't adjust them on circuit. They just sort of, they'll leave them as they are. They haven't changed since we set them up. So we set them up for the road, and if they do a track, they just kind of leave them, you know. They don't really spend a lot of time on it. So I can imagine if it was electronic, they could get themselves in a world.
As long as you can keep hitting reset.
Reset back to what it was. You have to have a long note. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it sounds like, but I 100% had that with my M2. I ended up fitting some like Bilstein Sport something dampers where you could adjust them a bit. And I adjusted them to like pretty soft in their travel, drove a little bit. And then I remember driving down like a country lane and was like, oh no, let's put them back somewhere in the middle and then like never mess with them ever again.
Yeah, you can get yourself in. And we often find when they come in and they're all different. The customer's changed, adjusted, and they're all now, they say, it's just how I want it. It's a bit, that's on full hard and that's on full stiff.
Yeah, but it's great.
Yeah. So
we'll put in our custom setting and put it back to factory. And they're like, oh yeah, that's so much better than stock.
Yeah, and sometimes you can give too many options.
Have you been running one of the new M2s, right?
Yeah, we've got the new M3 and M2. Yeah, it's good. They're both good cars, big cars. The new M2 is 20 mil wider than the GTR.
Whoa!
Yeah, it's massive. That's you don't realise just how big that car. Even to the last one, it's a huge car. So
that's crazy. And if someone brings their M2 in. What are you taking the engines? What are the sort of performance gains in the engine?
The engines are exceptional. They are amazing. So just the remap on the engine will take to kind of, I think, a 650 horsepower now for our stage one. That's with all the emission stuff left in place. It's just...
That's insane.
Yeah. Does it for fun. It's like this is the last go of a petrol engine, which it is. And they've just gone, well, there's all the stuff we do. And we'll just keep turning it up for as long as we can, as long as the emissions regulations allow. There's a GTR started off at 480 brakes, ended up at 600, but they didn't change anything on the engine. They just literally just
started
turning it out. The turbo's got a bit bigger, but the rest of the engine was the same. So they homologated it and kind of stress tested it for over 600 horsepower, and then they turned it all the way down.
Interesting.
Worked their way up through the life cycle.
And did they do that with, you see that in a lot of cars, don't you? So is that the same in an M3?
It's the same for all manufacturers. They'll homologate one lot of one design, one cost at the start, and then they'll make.
Yeah.
I'm sure they've already decided where they want to be in 5 years' time, where the market will be, and they'll just follow that trend. And every year they'll bring out a subtle change and they'll tweak the power. And it's the same for most companies over the years.
But they're an M2 engine and an M3 engine.
Exactly
the same.
Yeah. So that's just detuned in the M2.
Wow. So that, and yeah, I guess they'll do whatever they'll do, CS, GTS, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and it'll be the same.
And slowly ramp it up.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be the same base engine. Because why go through the pain of homologating an engine and all the cost and time when you can just do it once and then apply it through the rest of the range?
Yeah, that is 650 horsepower in a car like that. That's pretty...
Two-wheel drive, yeah.
That's pretty rowdy.
It is. You don't need any more than that. That's enough.
That is quite fun. And then have you been... have you been running a 992? You now have a GT3?
I've got a GT3 touring, yeah.
Do you like that?
That's amazing. Yeah. In fact, yeah, it's just a brilliant car. So we've got an RS, GT4 RS and a GT3 touring. And they're very different in character. But they're both amazing cars.
How do they sort of differ?
Well, the RS is full on, almost to the point you want to wind back, like it's loud. Like it's probably the loudest car I've ever been in. I don't know if you've driven a GT4 RS.
I've not been in one, no.
The first time you drive it, like the noise from the induction just behind your ears, you think, this is amazing. And then after a while, you know, once something starts to kind of annoy you a little bit. So it is loud. So we're going to just quieten that down a fraction. And I think we can improve the suspension a bit. But that's going to be like a keeper. That's just brilliant. Because it's bonkers. You know that
they've
just gone nuts with it. So that's great.
So in terms, that's interior volume that's the problem.
Well, I wouldn't say it's a problem. It's just something you just notice.
Intense.
It's just, yeah, it is intense. And when you're cruising around, it's quiet. It's just like any other 718. But when you put your foot down and the valves all open and it's this noise, even when you've got headphones on or you've got a helmet on. I took my daughter to the Nürburgring last year in the car and she loved it. She thought it was the greatest thing ever. But certainly... On the road, if you're cruising sensibly, it's fine. But when you start pushing on a bit, it's too loud, really. And on circuit. So we're just going to dial that down just a fraction. But the GT3 is just perfect out of the box, really.
Yeah.
I think we're doing the Krapovic exhaust on it. And then we just leave it because it's just great.
Yeah, yeah. I heard a rumor. I don't know whether you've worked on many, that they've subtly changed the suspension since it's come out.
I've spent a lot of time in the one of the first ones that came out.
Yeah.
And then this new one, the new one is definitely drives better than the old one. And I can't say what they've done or what they've changed, but it's definitely different. The ride quality is better, the steering's better. But then I saw on the ST that they said all of the mechanicals are the same. They just changed the software and the steering and the suspension. So you wonder how much of that has filtered through. Because it definitely rides better the new one than the old one. Not that the old one was particularly bad. I didn't have a problem with the old one, but this one's better.
That is interesting. Because that's the sort of standard kind of response, I think, to those cars at the moment. It's like they're quite hardcore touring is a GT3, isn't it?
Yeah, but I also think that going back to how sensitive the chassis is to setup, I think if you have the setup wrong on one or it's slightly out, it'll feel very different to one that's been optimized. So if a press car's gone out and it's done the rounds and then it ends up with the third or the fourth magazine, it's never going to drive as well as the people whizzing it around way or jumping over things for photos, whatever it might be. It will never drive as well as the first setup did. But as soon as it's reset, it'll be good as gold again. I also think when they were delivered, they had different tyre options.
Yeah.
So some came with Goodyears, some came with Pirellis. And I think that makes quite a big difference to the experience you get.
Have you tried some different ones?
I've driven it on the Goodyears and the Pirellis, and I think the Pirellis were better, a bit softer. I've also driven it on Michelins, and I probably prefer the Michelins overall on it. And like Cup 2s are better than all of them. The one I spent some time in before was on Pirellis, and this most recent one's got Cup 2s on it, and the Cup 2s are superb. So how much of that is down to the tyre choice, you know? And I never remember getting a choice when I ordered the car. So
I think you do.
I think you just kind of get what you're given, really. And I think that makes a huge difference because there's no way that the Pirelli is going to be as good on a circuit, say, as a Cup 2. The settings you'd have for a Cup 2 wouldn't be the same as what you'd have for the Pirelli. So you can see how it's easy to have. So see, some magazines would rave about how great it was and others would have been more lukewarm. And I wonder what spec they had.
Yeah, because I guess if your car comes on Cup 2s and it's optimized for Cup 2s,
yeah,
that's one thing. But if it comes on a variety of different tires from a variety of different manufacturers, some of which, like, you can get, I don't know whether you can have it delivered on Cup 2 R's, probably not.
It certainly has as an option.
So that, again, that's another step more where everything needs tweaking a little bit.
Yeah, it must be a nightmare for Porsche when they're giving stuff out to the press, because they need, particularly at the factory, they want to know that car is how they want it to be, not how it's ended up for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Because they'll inform people's opinions on the car, won't they? But no, I think it's brilliant. The car's amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember when the Amira came out, because that comes in like two specifications, like a touring and a not.
We've had an Amira, yeah.
Did you have what spec?
We had
in terms of suspension and stuff, did you have?
We had the V6 Touring. Sorry, we had the V6 with a track pack, but when we picked it up, it had the wrong software in it. So they then had to put the different software in. So I assume it had all of the correct suspension. But it doesn't matter that we changed the suspension to Nitrons and it made a massive difference, huge difference.
Oh, really? What sort of?
Rides better, more traction, the steering's more consistent, just better in every way, basically.
Do you find that sort of universally over the board of, if you put on, let's say, I'm not just saying like specifically Nitrons, but you're spending much more on a damper, I guess.
Yes. It's just, if you up the quality of the component, such an important component, then you're going to have an improvement. Even if you were just to mimic the original settings, but in a better component, you're going to have better suspension. So, you know, that's our kind of base premise always, is that if we start where they are, but they have a better damper. The Yaris is a prime example. The Yaris works really well in a very, very small window. So if you can expand that window out, then the ride quality, everything about it's better. And Toyota aren't going to fit a super expensive damper to a Yaris. They're going to use whatever they can.
But when you take something like a GT3, how do those sit against what you could buy? Like, I don't know anything about their dampers.
So to give you, there's no point in us doing a 992 kit, because I don't think there's anything we can really improve drastically on a 992. Yeah. I'm sure we could if we spent enough time, but no one's going to buy it, so it's a waste of time. Some of the older style stuff, like the Carrera T or the maybe even the RS, we can do suspension, because the RS is just quite firm. So I'd like to be able to, the conversations we had with Nitrons, we want to copy almost the damping on the track, the sports modes as it is.
Yeah.
But just give us a little bit more give in compliance the in the road version, just to soften it off. That's it. So we're not looking to change anything much. Just using better quality components to start with will make a huge difference.
And then you can get an adjustable damper, electronically adjustable damper that will range between those.
So they just push the button and it changes as normal. So there's no difference.
Yeah, nice. And then in terms of tuning 992s, you've been doing them for a while now. How has that evolved? Because I now have a GTS.
Yep.
I presume you can get, is that engine very similar in terms? Because I know 991, the GTS did have different stuff in it, didn't it?
So the engines are essentially the same. The engine's the same. They changed on the 992, they changed the fueling. They made the turbo symmetrical just to flow slightly better. There's a few subtle changes, and they all receive a GTS sort of size, the previous GTS size turbo. So the normal Carrera S had the GTS turbos, and your new GTS has the same size turbos. In both generations of car, the Carrera and the Carrera T models have slightly smaller versions. But the engines are the same. So the performance changes are huge for tuning. So obviously they're less on the GTS because your starting point's higher, but you still end up with like high 500s with a remap. Those engines are, again, it's end of Porsche's turbo petrol-powered engines. Yeah. They've just kind of chucked everything at it and they just make huge power with simple tuning.
They are, like that car to me feels really kind of like muscle car-esque. It's just got like tons of torque, which I use mine on the road and it's on Carrera S suspension rather than the GTS suspension. And it's actually just, it's just a lot of fun. Like,
the engine's perfect. My Carrera T is still my favorite car. It's got so much grunt low down, 600 horsepower. It's an absolute monster, you know, really. And it, but it picks up from like under 2000 RPM. It's pulling hard, you know, and it's, so there's at no point are you wanting for more performance from it. It's got everything you could ever want performance wise from it.
It's interesting. My sort of perception of what I want on the road has sort of changed in the last few years. Of previously, I love high revving engines, but like my 997 RS is like, you've really got to wring it out. And like doing that on the road, just unless I'm sort of in Europe, in which case I'm kind of a bit more on it.
Yeah.
I'm a little bit less on it when I'm at home. Yeah. I just don't want to be at 9,000 RPM all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm definitely really enjoying having a turbocharged, that turbocharged, at least the torque.
Yes.
It sounds like we're going to get with Gen 2, 992, some hybrids. I don't know what I've heard. Definitely the GT2 RS will be some sort of hybrid turbo.
The new GTS will be hybrid as well. Certainly the first kind of release will be some sort of hybrid. Should be interesting to see. I'm not sure. I'm not sure how it will. I just worry with these things that they'll obsolete so quickly. Yeah. And then it's not like you've had an incremental improvement as we've been used to, with each car is incrementally better than the last one. But you might prefer the character of the older one, or for whatever reason, that starts to gain value, or it's rarer, or whatever reason. And then the hybrids will come out, and they will be better than what is currently available. But you know the next one is going to be substantially better than this one, but not by a small margin, by a massive margin, which will then mean, why would you want to drive the old car with the big heavy battery and the, you know, it only gives you an extra 100 horsepower, whatever the thing might be, and it only does 10 miles an EV range, when the new one does 50 miles an EV range and weighs less? And I'd probably be cautious, really, to see how they evolve before I would.
Because I guess we've seen that in the sort of like the hypercar market of LaFerrari 918, etc. P1. P1's probably the one that I think is been held back the most by this hybrid in terms of now.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Yeah.
And people are starting to do stuff with it, like new battery packs and sort of stuff.
Yeah, but at least McLaren appear to be allowing some sort of update. And you've got like good companies like Lazanti doing some clever stuff with them, where they're kind of updating, they're bringing them up to date. Well, I don't think you're getting that with LaFerrari or 918. No. But they were the first, so maybe they will be looked back more fondly because that was the start of something. But you know the next one's going to be just so much better.
Yeah, because you look, but then it's accelerating so fast. Like if you look at, I mean, literally and but things. So you look at like a 296 now, and even SF90, like SF90, bit of a monster, but like no boot.
Yeah,
it's 1,000 horsepower, but it's quite heavy. 296 lighter, still crazy horsepower, so probably faster.
Yeah,
but it is quite a lot heavier. That's what we're going to see with the 911s. They're going to get like 150 kilos heavier or something.
And I get why they've got to do it. They've got to meet all these emissions regulations and stuff. But at what point do they start? Do they? Because if you can do for argument's sake, 50 miles on EV range in your new 911, then surely that'll pass kind of all the emissions regulations anyway, because it's just driving around on electricity. So do they stop developing it at that point because it ticked all the boxes, or do they have to just keep evolving it until eventually everyone's just driving electric 911s?
I think, I don't know whether it might just be like the run out, like you're saying with the GT4 RS, where we go, there is going to be some sort of hard deadline where they're going to stop making them.
Yeah.
Unless we get synthetic, whatever the other options are. So they might just go, let's just make the most mad thing.
I don't know. It's we actually did some synthetic fuel testing with a magazine a couple of weeks ago. So that looks interesting because it essentially performed the same.
Yeah.
And obviously Porsche spent a lot of money in that. And so you just don't know which direction the market's going to go. We've got electric cars here. We've got a Taycan, a Polestar and things. And they're amazing. But they're really just tools for going from A to B.
Yeah.
That's it. One's plusher than the other, and that's, you know, and the new one will be no doubt do 50 miles more, but
be a bit lighter, do more range, all that.
It's not particularly exciting.
Yeah. I sort of hope that we get to keep, when you look at the general mileage and like what's going on in the world, people driving sports cars is quite a small bunch of people.
Yeah.
It's quite a small amount of miles. Like if I think about the mileage I do in sports cars, it's nothing. I mean, I don't even do that many miles anyway.
Yeah.
If my day to day is an electric, then like, so what?
Yeah. And you can buy the synthetic fuels now. Obviously they're quite expensive, but not if you're doing relatively few miles, then it's, and you can afford the car in the first place, then you're probably not going to balk at the cost of, you know, buying a synthetic fuel, which lets you keep running the car effectively emissions free, as we tried with the cars the other week. So it's an interesting time. There's obviously going to be a lot of change. I wouldn't want to be a big car manufacturer at the moment, though.
It does. Even when you look at, you said you had a Polestar. Didn't last week Volvo's, I don't know the inner politics of that, but Volvo's basically said, yeah, we don't want to own any of Polestar. Thank you very much.
They're doing a lot of marketing now. There's advertising, which I've never seen before. It's a great car. You can't fault it for a mode of transport. It's just white good.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, we've got it out for sale. We've not had anybody ring up to buy it, you know. It's the cheapest one in the UK. But I don't think if anyone's interested.
It's a very funny time to be buying any cars, really.
Yeah.
There's some really cheap stuff.
We bought the Taycan because Porsche were doing a really good deal on the Taycan at the time, just before Christmas. And it's fantastic, but I wouldn't want to own it long term, you know.
What have you gone for?
GTS Taycan. Okay. Like I say, it's brilliant. Really, really nice car. Really well finished. Super comfy, quiet, very quick. But it's just not exciting, is it? It's just, it is your daily driver.
Yeah. And it makes your rowdy 1500 horsepower GTR or whatever seem.
Well, it gives
it a bigger contrast.
Yes,
doesn't
it is. It is. Yeah. And we're fortunate that we have some really nice cars that we either have for development or for testing that we can use. And being a car enthusiast, you get to experience. I'm sure we will have the hybrid Porsche because we'll need to see what we can do to it, how we do it. I just don't see how long. And then a lot of customers, they don't keep their Porsches for long anyway. They might only have it for 1 or 2 years and then have the next thing. So ultimately, it doesn't really matter to them. It's just interesting to see how the market is changing.
Yeah, and it sounds like that I'm really in. My GTS is a manual. And my previous one was a PDK. And for some reason, that I don't know, for me, that has made a big difference to just to how much I use the car. I think it...
I use it more because
it's a manual. And I think it's probably that, it's almost like that white goods thing of, it's, you know, I wouldn't say a GTS is a white goods, but if you've got a bunch of cars and they're all automatics.
Yeah. You're just sitting in traffic.
And you're just like, let's say coming here, I'm just sitting in traffic down the motorway. Like it doesn't, you kind of just go, okay, well, which one's the most comfiest?
Yeah.
Whereas if it's a manual, like, okay, but I'm going to get a different experience in that car.
Yeah.
It sounds like what I'm hearing with the hybrids is there won't be a manual hybrid.
Okay. Yeah, I'd imagine there'd be a lot of control issues if it was manual. Yeah. So it would be a lot easier for them to control what the car's doing if it was PDK. The PDK is the best gearbox on the market, so you can't fault it.
Yeah.
But I chose manual for the GT3 and Carrera T and things, it's a lot more involving, isn't it?
It is a lot more involving. But it will be interesting to see that the sort of last rung. You say, take the current GT3 RS, make it a GT2 RS with like 1,000 horsepower or what? It could be close to that.
Yeah, it'll be crazy. I'll have to experience it, obviously, because it sounds brilliant. But yeah, and also, how far extreme do they become? So like the new GT3 is so extreme.
Agreed.
Does that limit them? It's amazing they've made it. It's amazing they've made it look like that and perform like that. But does it, obviously they must have reduced their market options because not everybody will want something that wild.
But they sell them all.
Yeah, I know. But are people buying them, again, back to what we discussed last time, are people buying them because they've got this idea they're going to make money on them and that's why they're in such demand?
Yeah.
Or are they actually buying it because they're going to use it? You go to Nürburgring, there's loads of them. They're getting used properly. You know, it's great to see. But are the cars in the UK, they're not doing any miles. They're just sat in a garage. They can say, well, I've got a GT3 RS.
Yeah, I'd love to know
$100,000 in it.
The split.
Yeah.
And if you can't, you've got to say this, like, if there was no financial stuff in it, but there is, so it's kind of difficult to sort of remove that, how many people would actually buy one?
Because how many people are going to chuck a $200,000 car around a track? $250,000 car by the time you spec it, you know? So that's what it's designed to do. So you've got to be able to, and if you're going to drive something that wild, you're going to drive it fast.
Or at least you need to be enjoying yourself.
Yes.
And I would want to be feeling some of the stuff. Yeah. I'm going to be playing with my settings and then get it wrong.
Yeah. And then you have to be able to afford to deal with it if the worst was to happen. Whereas I fear that a lot of them will just sit in the garage.
Yeah. I wonder what it's like on the road though.
It's supposed to be good.
It's meant to be quite good.
Yeah.
And what I hear is if you put it in the track mode and you dial down the suspension, it's softer than the GT3.
Yeah. Yeah. I wondered if the ST was going to get the...
I thought it might.
Yeah, I thought that would be quite a good point of difference because you could really kind of dial it in then. But the fact that everyone's raved about how good the ST is as it is. So I'd like to experience one of those. You eventually get to a position where you can get a GT3 and then they tempt you with the next carrot that's down. Oh, you know, if only you'd bought a few more, only if you did, you could have got an ST or you could have got an R or do you know what I mean? It never ends. And no matter how cynical or sensible you are as a business person, you still get sucked into the same hamster wheel of trying the next thing all the time.
100%. And it's fun.
It is fun. It is. Specking a car, doing that stuff is great fun. Yeah.
And you get excited, like, you know, if you're into your cars and they've released the GT3 RS, that's one of the most interesting cars.
Yeah.
It's always going to be one of the most interesting cars to me, but the technology they put into it makes it significantly more interesting than like other road cars.
That is a really clever car. That is really, and much more so than the previous generations. The previous generations have always been a slightly more extreme version than the GT3, which is always fundamentally a very well-designed car. But this thing with all the electronic adjustment is something else on a different level.
And since sort of on my personal journey, since like 997 RS was a great road car. And also you can drive it on track and it was a good track car and whatever. When it went to 991, it went a lot more serious and it was only PDK only for the RSs. And that, it sort of became less interesting for me because I was like, I'm mainly going to drive this on the road.
Yeah.
Okay, a bit less involving. And then as that got more hardcore, I'd be like, yeah, I can see why people are banging them just around tracks, but maybe you get a cup car, I don't know.
Yeah.
Different proper position, running it, etc. But when 992 came out, I was like, oh yeah, Mark, I'd quite like to try one of those on a track. Like, I think that would be quite cool.
But similarly to me, I'm interested from the engineering and then playing around with the suspension almost more so than the performance of the car.
100%. I don't care about the lap time.
Yeah, exactly. I just want to go, oh, it was better.
Yeah.
It was better.
I want to wind open the diff on the way into that did not work. Yeah,
that would be, and you can imagine the hours of boring conversation you could have with people about your diff settings.
Exactly. You come to the pits, but oh, did you try? Oh, yeah. One plus on the under locking to acceleration.
I could think of quite a few of our customers and friends that we could spend hours boring each other with those conversations.
It's 100% one of those ones where, like, if you get it, If you're like, if that's kind of interesting, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
For everyone else, they're like, what are you talking about? Why would I ever want to do that?
Surely the guys in Germany had a much better idea. Yeah. That's their job. They'll leave it to them to sort it out. Yeah.
Was it like most cars, if you just like, don't even necessarily put them in sport, they're faster around a track? There's a lot of cars that, like, by not putting them in the sportier, stiffer setting.
A lot of it comes down to the driver confidence and the fact that a lot of drivers aren't experienced track drivers. They do it for fun. We did, years ago, we did a suspension kit. We still sell it now. We've done hundreds of them for the GTR. And we designed a suspension kit with Bilstein. And we thought, oh, this will make the car faster on track. And we put, a journalist drove it who's a good driver, but not a really experienced driver. And I want to say he was 2 seconds a lap faster around Bedford. But then they put Evo Magazine had Richard Meaden drive the car and he was only half a second faster.
Interesting.
So because he's obviously an exceptional driver, he doesn't have the confidence element. He doesn't need it. He can just drive as fast as that car will go. Whereas the more inexperienced driver is benefiting from the damper settings that allows him to be confident to drive the car faster. And that's where the lap time comes from. So I do wonder if some of those things are just that the average driver is able to utilize the car better.
Yeah, there's a lot in that. I think that's probably an underappreciated thing about something like the Manti upgrades.
Yes.
I think for most drivers, it makes the car much more confidence inspiring. So your outright pace is not, it's a bit far, well, it is faster.
Yeah.
But for most people, we'll get a significant jump in performance in lap time.
Yes. And so the Nürburgring in particular, so from a BMW point of view, so the settings you would have for the dampers around the Nürburgring are very, very different to how you'd have it around on the road or even around, say, Silverstone. So you can then attack things like curbs. The bumps won't, the rebound won't be anything like as much. So the car feels less nervous. It just sort of squats and goes. So from a driver's point of view, you can just keep pushing and pushing and pushing because things just compressing all the time. And it's not getting taken off over every bump. It's just riding over them. But on the road, you feel like you're sat on the spring and the cars are bobbling about.
Okay,
it's hideous. It makes you feel ill. So we said a lot of people that will go to Germany and have Nürburgring settings put on their car and they spend a lot of money. And essentially they've had these very soft damping put on, stiff springs, and they'll put slicks on it. And of course they'll drive around the ring and they'll go, wow, it's transformed. The car is so much faster. Well, yeah, it's got slicks on it. And now you're not bouncing around as much because the suspension is a lot more compliant. To set a car up something like a GT4 RS or GT3 RS, they've done such a good job to allow it to do everything.
Mm.
To still do a lap time at Silverstone and at the Nürburgring and be more compliant on the road, as you say, that's very clever. But then those dampers are very, very different. They fit to anything else. They're a completely different setup.
Oh, really? Interesting. So I know if you look at, let's say, the Manti upgrades that they do, they do some suspension upgrades, but they're taking it from road car stuff to like GT3 car.
Yeah. It's a GT3 damper that's been optimized for circuit. Yeah. And I haven't spent much time in a Manti car on the road, but I would suggest it won't ride as well as the standard car will because it'll be focused for the circuit. But on the circuit, it'll be different level.
Yeah.
But they're going to the nth degree. There's different arms on the car. There's different aero pieces, there's the blades on the rear, gone to every little part of it. And I saw the prototype for the GT3 RS at the Nürburgring, and the site, because the wings are already the biggest wing you've ever seen. Now they've gone even bigger. I don't even know how that conforms to road legal. Maybe it's a track only thing. But then you get to the point where, well, at what point do you just buy a GT3 track car?
Yeah. I don't know. It's that one is an interesting one, because if you've done like some racing, you immediately go, well, you just get a race car. But then I think as time goes on, I sort of also appreciate that you can just drive it to the track, drive around the track and drive home. So there is an element of that in it. But when you're buying, I don't know, a Senna, or as this goes up and up and up, your behemoth.
Yeah. But how many Sennas are you going to see on a track day? I mean,
not many.
No. So it's like, There's not many people out there, and even more, it must be great for their warranty division that cars never go out of the garage.
Well, don't with the, like with McLarens, I don't know whether you used to have to take it to a McLaren dealership before you went on a track day.
Yeah, a lot of manufacturers are like that. Nissan used to do it with the GTR. They would say you had to go have a pre-track inspection and a post-track inspection to keep your warranty void, to valid, sorry. It's just, there's this, yeah.
Which I understand. Like, it's a bit lame, but I understand it.
Yeah, but they also have, you know, they have to, if they're promoting a vehicle...
Agreed.
Based on its track performance, they have to support the customers that then use it on track. But they've got not just the warranty side to think about, but they've also got the road safety side. And you know how some people drive on track. They can be pretty abusive. Hmm. And it wouldn't take much to knock wheel bearings out, hub nuts and stuff like that, which can be checked if it goes back into the dealer. I don't know anyone who ever took it back into the dealers, but that's what they said that you should do. So it kind of covered them.
It works from a sort of safety type, and I can see from the warranty. It does give me a lot more appreciation for like how Porsche treat it, which is basically seems to be like, okay, but if you do like about 5 track days or less a year, happy days.
Well, I think that company in general is a lot more confident in their products, aren't they? You only see it with the magazines where there'll be a, you can't drive my car without this fleet of engineers we've brought with you.
Yeah.
Don't mention them. But you can drive the car once we've set it up versus Porsche, that some guy just turns up in a lorry and goes, there's the keys, mate. See you later.
Tire presses are probably right.
See you later. Enjoy it. Be back next week.
Yeah.
So I think, they're a lot more confident in their, and rightly so, in their products.
Which is impressive. Super impressive. Talking of 911s, Jethro's 996. Is that... still evolving as a product? Is it sort of finished now?
It was finished, I don't know, 6 months ago. It's finished, but there's always things we can do. There's always things we can add and change. It never ends, basically.
Never ends.
Really
like
he's really enjoying it.
Frustrating, smash your head against a wall kind of way.
It's never that bad. It's fun. It is fun. But it's only become fun when we made the decision we'd never do it again. So then now it's like, we'll just work on Jeffrey's car and we'll do these bits. Because when you take the commercial side of it out, then it's different.
Yeah.
And at the time, in concept, it was a good idea. But none of us had done any research into what would be involved. And that was the schoolboy error that we continue to pay for now. he came in, he'd been to various specialists and had some issues, and he'd asked us to look at the suspension, and then we're like, Jeffrey, you do know there's a crack in your engine, and this is leaking, and then this has got a problem. And I'm like, oh. So you could rebuild it. The options are rebuild it as it is, but then it would still be a 996 engine with the various issues that they have. And then he sort of said, well, what about putting a new engine in? I thought, yeah, there's similar kind of money by chance. So, and we were like, oh, it might be like a lot of other Porsche products and BMW where everything's interchangeable. You could just put the new one in the old one and it's all the same sizes. Yeah, that's a good idea. We should do that. So then he started looking for engines. And then by chance, a friend of mine owns a salvage yard and he rang up and said, well, I rang him and said, do you know of any engines? And he said, well, I've actually just had this car in that had been parked up and a lorry had like a dustbin lorry or something had hit it down the side.
Oh, right.
And it had stove the door in, but it had creased the A-pillar. So the company had written it off, but the car fundamentally was fine, but the body was terrible. So it had the engine in the box. We thought, well, we can put it in one go. And then we started to realize all the things that were missing and needed. So it was lucky we had the car because we could take like fuel parts out of it.
Right.
We could rob some of the air conditioning parts, make it fit with the old ones. If we hadn't have had that, then it wouldn't have worked at all. So that was the only bit of fortune we had in the whole project. I think the rest of it was one continual slog.
And so presumably, unlike, I know lots of the air-cooled cars, you can sort of pretty much put different engines in, et cetera. This is not the case from 996 to...
It would have been easier for us to put a V8 in it or a GTR engine in it or something. Do you know what I mean? It's just because it's got a Porsche badge on it and it's for a 911. yeah, it doesn't fit at all. It's new subframes. We've got to modify the chassis to make things fit. The gearboxes are different sizes. But that was actually the easy bit compared to the electronics of trying to make everything integrate.
Right, yeah.
Because you have an old style car with an old communication network on it. You have the modern car with direct injection, drive-by-wire throttles, driver wires, just all sorts. It took us a week just to get the aircon to work because we're having to tell the new ECU we had on there how to operate these different things. It's just so much. And just as you finished one thing, you would then open up the next can of worms to deal with. So like the power steering is electronic, so it has a different pump or lack of pump on the engine for help the emissions on the newer car, whereas the old car has a proper pump. You can't fit that. So then we had to fit the steering off of a cup car, but that needs different components. And then you have to, it just went on and on and on. So we're really, it drives amazing. It's amazing. Just like I say, I would never, ever do it again.
Never do it again.
We had so many people ring up. So how much have you charged for it? I'm just not doing it.
Yeah, we've done it.
It's worth doing it.
Like, it's a large number and I don't want to do it.
It's we gave up adding it up. It's no point. And like I said, you would need to have pretty much a donor car to be able to do it. And at that point, at what point do you just go and buy a new GT3? Because it was going to cost you the same money.
Yeah, to buy a 996 C2S or whatever.
And yeah. Why would you wouldn't?
The unloved generation.
This is a great little car. It's great. And as a company, we learn so much from it. So there is a benefit from doing it. It's just not a profitable.
Could have been a different car, different engine, different outcome. But yeah, presumably.
If I'd gone back, I'd just say, Jeffrey, just get a reconditioned engine, put it in, be done with it. Off you go, see you later. That's all finished. But no, we took the high road.
Do you think in terms of how those cars have evolved, so like 997, 991, 992, how do those change a lot between?
They have. So 996 and 997 are essentially the same platform. So they're pretty similar. 991 is a different platform and 992 is very different. 992 is much bigger. So although the engines are the same and the architecture is a little bit more complex than the 992, 991 is a sort of halfway between the two. I remember when I first got my 991, I thought it was a big car, but it's nothing compared to 992 is much
bigger.
It's
insane, isn't it?
Yeah. And if you park them back next to each other, it dwarfs it.
Yeah.
And then if you park this in 996, it looks really quite dinky, the 996. But I've got a 993, which is even smaller again. The 964, 993 platform is sort of the air-cooled ones, one lot. Then you jump to the water-cooled of 996, 997, and then so on. So,
yeah, I do look at 99. I do quite like, I like 992s, but I do look at them and go, they would look really great if they were about, I don't know, 10% smaller. And then you go, oh, that's literally what the 991 looks like.
Yes. Well, I think, I mean, I heard that they'd made it that size in anticipation for the hybrid system.
Okay.
So the kind of the first generation 992 is probably larger than it needs to be because the second generation will have
space,
more space for whatever it is they have to put in it.
And it's a much more capable car, isn't it? Like, I mean, is that what you want? I don't know. But like, if you were trying to do laps, a base 992 is a lot faster than a 991.
It is. The front suspension is much better on the 992 generation GT3 than the previous one. The normal 992, they just improve as an object, a boring car, all the boring stuff they do better than the last one. It's just everything works better. It goes better.
Although if you've got a manual, you'll appreciate the cup holders.
Yes. Yeah. There is that.
What is that?
They've obviously thought, it's a bit of space, but that's again, designer versus usage, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm not convinced on the PDK.
No, they'll nub it all thing.
What's that all about? There's certain ergonomic things that you would say was a mistake, but as a car, it's just a better thing to drive.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And actually, with the little PDK selector, with the RS and the GT3s, they gave you
like a gear knob back again.
Kind of a gear knob type thing. So they do.
I do wonder if it's like a completely different department, though.
Yeah.
Like, just let them get on with what they want. We'll just worry about what we do.
You do your sort of road cars to sell to, like, I don't know, just general people.
Yeah.
live in town and drive around in a 911. And then,
yeah, we'll do the high end stuff.
By the way, on this race car, we need this. Oh, okay. Okay. Deep in there, we'll have that somewhere.
Yeah.
Just for when we need full mental mode. Yeah. Yeah. They're very cool. All right. Well, I normally wrap this up with 5 questions. You've been on it before, so I'll do a condensed version. These generally change a little bit. If you're going to drive one sports car for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Well, I don't know. Ford GT.
Ford, which one?
The last generation.
Like 06?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was an amazing car. It is an amazing car. Love it.
I was talking to someone about these recently. They're awesome.
They're amazing. But we had it when we brought over one of the first ones into the UK. This was 2004, 2005, I can't remember now, a long time ago. And it was just silly, but it was so easy to work on. And we had Carrera T at the time, Carrera GT at the time, Zonda for a customer that we were looking after, and a Koenigsegg. And they were just...
That's quite a collection of cars.
Yeah, the customers would bring in, we'd look after, but they were so complicated. Well, we got a Bugatti EB110.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to change the spark plugs, you had to have a special tool. I mean, somebody had to have done these things on purpose to make it so awkward to work on. And then the Ford GT comes along. Oh, you can get a filter from the motor. Everyone's thought about what air it goes. It just works.
Yeah.
You know, it's just brilliant. And it's really fast, handles really well, relatively light. Just thought it's a great car. Really
sound
fun.
Awesome.
Sound everything you want a supercar to be. It's silly. Just great.
Yeah.
I bang my head on the doors every single time I get out, no matter how many times I get in and out of one. I just think they're amazing cars and they're just really fun. And everything's overtaken it now in terms of performance. But yeah, if you want to have one silly car in the garage, I guess
they've aged really well.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had the new one here few times, and that's a great car, but it's not got the character of the old one.
No.
And I wonder how important engines will be in the future, because that the new one's got run of the mill 3.5 twin turbo engine and it's got no real character to it. But the old one, the big silly V8 with a supercharger on it, we put on when we look after one for one customer, it's got the Ford Racing make an exhaust system for it, which sounds like it should be at Le Mans or something.
Yeah.
And that's from Ford. And they do a different pulley for the supercharger to give it more power. And it's all, again, from the factory. So this thing's like 600 and something horsepower. It sounds like thunder. And, yeah, it's just great. It's everything you want it to be.
Yeah. You do think if you sort of extend the paths that we're on now and you go, okay, everyone's going to be driving electric cars day to day, electric sports cars will be, already are, insanely fast. Like...
But you might not be able to use them. I watched Harry's garage video the other day and he was driving the new Aston and he said that they might mandate some sort of speed limiters soon.
Yeah, they might.
So if you've got that coming down the line, what's that one going to do to the values of the one just before where you don't have the nanny state?
It would stop me updating my 911.
Wouldn't it? You'd just be like, oh, it's bad enough at the moment of getting in the car having to constantly turn off. Like, I had a Golf Mark 8 GTI, GTI Club Sport. And if you left the steering assistance on, the thing wanted to kill you. It was horrendous how bad that was. And let alone trying to adjust anything on the touchscreen when you're driving along. Mm. It was a death trap, that car. As soon as you turned it off, it was sensible. It was a really good front-wheel drive chassis. It was fantastic. Every time you had to go in the car, and you couldn't do it quick and easily, there was menus you had to go through, and just that would put me off if that's what we're going.
That's true. That's true. And I don't think we're going to get less of that.
I mean, they could just put buttons.
That would be really nice.
That would be good, wouldn't it? You could just go off, off. And even better, you could just select individual or something and it automatically has it turned off.
I hope we get that. Like, I've got a little Peugeot electric car and it's got steering assist and whatever, but it's just either on or off. It doesn't default on and you just have a button that you can turn it on and off. Great. That's fine.
And in your normal day-to-day car, it's really good. Like the Porsche system, or we had an Audi before, So they adapted cruise controls, fantastic, on the motorway. Absolutely brilliant. And I would have it on all the time, almost like a second pair of eyes. But when you're just driving around these country lanes, you don't want to have these things pulling and tugging for no good reason, yeah. And particularly if there's a car coming the other way and you're having to,
yeah.
You're now having to try to fight against your own car. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is insane. And I've heard someone on a podcast was talking about the speed limiters or like what we might get. And unfortunately, I don't think there is a good argument for not having speed limiters on cars. Now, what you set that limit at, I guess, is the question. For me personally, I think a sensible number is like plus 20 or something like that. Because if it's literally the speed limit, you're going to have accidents.
Yes.
Someone's going to try to overtake, and then they're going to be like, the person's done that thing where you've overtaken them and they've gone, I'm going to accelerate.
Yeah.
But you'll be limited to the same speed and you'll just bin it. But there's no really, I think there's a good argument for allowing you to just drive as fast as you want.
Well, we don't tend to anyway, because you'd like to think we all know people's speed and it can cause problems. But in the main, people control their speeds for the environment they're in. You know, that's
The ones that do my head in is when you see someone, I've been pulled up, not pulled over, but shouted at by people in a town driving a loud sports car, and they're going, slow down, you're going so fast. And they will have not noticed the Range Rover that's just gone past at like 50 in a 20.
Yeah.
They just won't see it.
Yeah.
It'll have gone past. And like, you know, you actually shouldn't. The people that drive fast in towns and stuff when it's like a 20, you should, I think there's a solid argument. They say maybe you shouldn't drink. It's like, yeah, okay, but maybe you shouldn't be allowed to drive at 60.
Yeah. They have to do something to kind of to make sure we're all safe. But at the same time, there's, like anything, you can go too far.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I don't think the control systems are there anyway. That's what the Golf proved. And if that's obviously a huge company like VAG Group can't get the Golf to feel safe, then it's not ready.
And I don't think GPS is good enough and accurate enough to do speed limits, because we've all had it. If you've got a car, I'm sure your Taycan has it, where it reads the speeds, and you'll be in like on a 50 and it will think you're on the 30 or the 20 that's underneath it or to the left.
If that had a limiter, is it going to slam the brakes on?
I think at that point it would slam the brakes on.
I've just gone through into a 30, slam the brakes on, but the car behind is a generation behind and hasn't noticed, and you're into the back of it.
I think if those rules do come in, the value of the pre those rules cars
will be huge. Yeah.
Especially if it's a sports car.
Yeah. But how do they control it, monitor it? It all seems easy for someone to go, yeah, we should have, but if you can't enforce it properly, or you can't control it or maintain it and all these things, or even work properly, then it needs serious consideration. Hopefully, it's just one of those myths that is building up, that someone's mentioned somewhere we should have this and it's kind of escalated.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Anyway, if you only drive one car for the rest of your life.
Don't drive one. Control system.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more?
I would say 991 GTS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a nice car.
Really good car. Really good car.
Having just bought a new GTS, I'm aware of what you can buy a new GTS for secondhand. It's not a lot. I presume a 991 GTS is like 80.
Yeah, probably.
Probably.
Yeah, maybe less. I just think maybe less. Money, obviously, it's still a lot of money, but it's, you know, I think it's just a great, if you just had to have one car, it does.
It's got the back seats. It's kind of fun.
Economical, practical, very fast, steers great.
Yeah.
Depreciates steadily. You know, it's just a really good build quality, superb. So I'd probably say that at the moment.
Yeah. And a really nice, a really good looking car. That shape is good. Most interesting car to you?
Probably the new GT3 at the moment. GT3 RS, sorry. At the moment. I think that's, I think that and the Yaris are two of the kind of bravest cars that manufacturers have put out recently, just because I think they've done an amazing job with it.
Yeah. Have you seen the new The new Yaris.
Get it in June, apparently.
Okay.
Yeah, should see it just before. We're supposed to get our cars in June, but we should see the car beforehand.
Yeah. And they've changed. What have they changed? I know they've done seating positions a bit different and interiors a bit different.
I think it's brilliant. A company that big can listen to the kind of criticisms that the original car had, and they're really quite minor ones, relatively. And they've improved it. They've got, you know, we had problems with cooling. Lo and behold, there's all new cooling ducts on it and new radiators. They've changed the seating position because people complained that we sat too high. Lots of little incremental improvements. They changed the front suspension, top mounts. I thought it was brave. In the press launch, I saw that they'd laid out all the kind of broken components.
Oh, really?
They said, this is the weakness we've had with gear linkages. This is the weaknesses we've had with this. And I thought that was, again, a company that's so confident in their product, they can say
they're just being straight honest. Yeah, they're like, this is what it is.
Yeah, and it's they've sold way more than they ever thought. The ownership demographic we see is very different. You know, we weren't expecting so many wealthy people to be buying Yaris's as third, fourth, fifth cars, but they love it. And of course, then they naturally spend money on them because they've got disposable income to spend on it, improving it. So that's been really good. And I think the new one will be the same again. It will just, they won't sell as many.
It'll just keep going, won't it?
Yeah. Well, they said now it's going to be a full-time kind of part of the range. I think that market's always been there. Subaru had it, Mitsubishi had it, but they just chose not to cater for that customer any longer. So the Yaris has come along. They've got all this kind of pent up demand and everyone's reliving their kind of Mitsubishi.
It's weird how that's sort of happened. And I wonder if it's because it's a hatch. I think it fits that sort of target market much better than like a GR86. I mean, they've sold those out anyway, but like GT86 type car. Cause I think lots of people have a small hatchback, a small car that is practical, but they use for just running around.
Yeah, it is. It is very practical. Well, relatively, because it's a hatch. But also, I think it goes unnoticed as well. Yeah. Most people would never even know the difference between a normal Yaris and the GR Yaris. Or, you know, it's just, but it is just really fun. And I think people appreciate that Toyota even made it. Well, I do, because I think it's a brave thing. They didn't need to make, well, they wanted to do the rallying, but they didn't need to continue making it. But they're choosing to cater for that relatively small market.
Yeah, it's been an amazing move and play by them.
Great marketing.
And hopefully it'll continue. Five car garage, unlimited value.
Ford GT.
Yeah.
GT3, new
GT3. Not an ST.
Yeah, you probably would have the ST, actually, wouldn't you? If you could have it,
you'd
have
it. If you're just going for it, yeah.
You'd probably have it. What's that? Two cars. I'd have a GTR. Definitely have a GTR.
How would your GTR be decked out?
It wouldn't be, it would have, we did an LM20 model to celebrate 20 years in business, 2016-17. And that's kind of how I'd spec a GTR. It was 660 brake, probably have a bit more power than that. But it had our suspension handling. It was just OEM plus rather than a
crazy.
Yeah. And that was really nice. So probably a slightly more powerful version of that. What else?
You got two more slots. So you got some sort of family wagon or something?
You'd have to have one of those, wouldn't you? You'd probably have to have some kind of electric car as your daily of some sort.
Probably.
So you'll have to go with a Taycan, really.
New one of those coming soon, I think.
Yeah, but it's obviously
getting released this week.
Yeah,
maybe?
It's not drastically different, though, from what I've seen. Well, from the little information.
I think it is the same.
Yeah.
And a bit more tech.
A bit more range. So this GTS is supposed to 316 miles, whatever it is. But every time I've charged it up, it never shows more than 240.
Yeah.
And then when you ring them up, they're like, oh, well, it's because it's cold. And you're like, well.
No, you talk to anyone that's got a Taycan and none of them do more than like 220
miles an
hour. They're all the
same. Yeah. So I'd have one of those. And then one, I'd probably have to have the Praga Behemoth.
Mm.
Just because that would be the quickest thing you could own.
And a nice tie-in.
Yeah. And a good tie-in, yeah.
Yeah, good garage.
So expensive garage, but it'd be a good garage.
Well, yeah, and it is unlimited budget. So that is the thing. Well, thanks very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.